Hey there, this is Eben Matthews once again, back with a new episode of the Mythmakers podcast. This is another of our very special Makerverse episodes, this time with the phenomenally talented Alex Ogle. We've got a new series on Macroverse called The Changing Tales that Alex makes. He'll talk about it, we'll talk about it. It's fantastic. We get into a bunch of his process using Illustrator to ink, which is a geeky and awesome thing for those of us that ink stuff. Very, very cool stuff all the way around. We actually recorded this to come out with episode one of The Changing Tales, which came out last week on the 27th of July, I believe. Somewhere around there. But we held it, we decided to hold it until the second episode came out, is coming out tomorrow, which will be Monday, August 3rd. So when you hear this, there will be two episodes of The Changing Tales on the Macroverse app, and episode one will now be free to read as well. So when we talk about the release date, just know you can actually go read two right now. Episode one is free, episode two is for subscribers, but of course you can grab a 7-day free trial and read everything that you possibly can within that 7-day free trial. We encourage it. Go do it. Let us know what you think. Awesome stuff ahead. Stay tuned.
Adam.
Eben, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Well, indeed. In isolation, you know.
In isolation. Good. Yes. Well, there is that. So we are here today with a very special guest for another special edition of the Mythmakers podcast in our Makerverse series. We have Mr. Alex Ogle with us today.
Hey.
And hello.
Hey.
Yay.
Yay.
So very excited to have Alex and talk to him more. Alex is one of the people we're working with on the Macroverse platform, which we are so in love with, and you're probably tired of us talking about. We're very
excited. It's only going to get worse, I think.
It's true. That's true. Prepare for the ultimate annoyances. Or just enjoy. Just join us in loving it. I think that's the real solution.
But that's the Zen way of going about it. I prefer, you know.
The takeover of your brain share is well underway. So anyway, we'll let Alex kind of tell more of his story. But just as the kind of kick stuff off, Alex, give us a little bit of your secret origin.
Ah, okay. Well, you want the short version?
it's really up to you. I tend to be a little long winded at times, feel free to tell me to shut up. We love this stuff, so give us the version that you like to share. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think somewhere when I first started getting into comics is probably a good place to start. I was a young kid and growing up in Kansas in a small town there, and comics were everywhere at the time. It was the early 80s, mid 80s, and I could get comics at the grocery store or the gas stations, and they were prevalent, even in a small town. And wow. And so it was, I was really into it. I loved that. And I got into X-Men, and Excalibur was one of the early first when it started with Alan Davis drawing it. That was a big book for me. And then that kind of led me into X universe, and then the X-Men exploded, and then the whole 90s happened, and we got Image and all of that stuff. So,
yeah.
But I followed that whole train and loved that stuff and wanted to do comics. And then, so growing up there, I got into drawing a lot and, everything. And then eventually I went into college and started drawing my own books and studied design for a while. And 'cause I thought that would make sense, to transition the comics, knowing how to use computers and knowing how to, you know, paste up new stuff, build books. Mm-hmm. And so, really went into that, just taught myself illustration, worked on that for a while, and then started getting into the industry some and trying to do independent books, and get illustration jobs.
Yeah.
And so that was the mid to late 90s when I started getting into actually drawing books. Worked with a small company, Amaze Inc., which was part of Slave Labor at the time. I had a book series there that I started, and then that ended, and I was a poor, starving artist at the time. And so I
can't relate to that at all.
I transitioned more into graphic design at that point, kind of got away from comics a little bit, and then started a company shortly thereafter, kind of doing online animation and stuff, and that kind of took off. And we had a property that we developed called Giant Nitro, which was a black and white animation, and that started, kind of went viral before things went viral back then. So we were selling t-shirts off our site, just doing these little short animations that were kind of like, we'd shoot our friends like with video cameras, then I'd convert it into vector animation. We'd post that on the internet through Flash, and basically we're streaming video before you could really stream video on the
internet. Right.
And so those were pretty big. Everybody started talking about that all over the place. I had interviews with all sorts of magazines. Then we got contacted by a company called Eruptor Entertainment, which was a spinoff company of some people that worked at Cop Cow. And then, so I worked with them, ended up purchasing some rights to my property. So I worked with them and worked on that stuff for several years, where we'd film on set and kind of up the budget quite a bit. Then instead of me just shooting my friends for beer and pizza money, we actually had budgets, and we had people building sets and shot on a sound stage and did it all. And so that was a lot of fun. Worked with some real actors. Thomas Jane, Olivia Dabo were our main two actors in the series. And they ended up directing some. And, of course, Mark Silvestri ended up directing some of the episodes as well. So I worked closely with him. And he drew all the storyboards. So seeing my own character drawn by him in storyboard form was amazing.
Totally.
And so then the bottom fell out of the internet at that time, the internet boom or bomb or whatever they call it, kind of imploded a little bit for the entertainment side. So everything went to e-commerce and kind of got away from building animations online. And so then I went and just did that for a while and just kind of lived in the design world. I experimented with things there, though. I love to experiment with comics and all sorts of form of kind of media stuff. And so I was working with QuickTime quite a bit. And there was a time when people would make custom skins in QuickTime.
Yeah.
And they would post those up.
I remember.
All the, it was a big deal at the time, right? All the movies would come out, they'd release a trailer and have a custom skin. And the video would actually leap out of your browser and be in QuickTime and play right there. Well, I experimented with that technology, did that for indie bands and stuff and at my company. And then we won the Apple Award. So I got tied more into Apple. I was a speaker at a WWDC for them on Interactive QuickTime. And that kind of went all over the world, too. I mean, it got popular. So I was talking at, like, conferences in Hong Kong and stuff like that in France.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so it was a lot of fun. I love to experiment. So that was always my thing. And so I got to... I hit 40 years old and I was like, I want to do comics again. And so I started experimenting with that stuff and doing more Kickstarters and all that. Like when I was in the late 90s, when I was trying to do independent books, there was no Kickstarter or any kind of crowdfunding system. So it was really hard. And so when I saw that stuff come out, I was like, okay, I'm going to be on this bandwagon. So I started doing different books and writing, illustrate my own stuff and doing Kickstarters to support that. And so it was a fun little side kind of projects and stuff where I was doing my design company.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So that's where I've been since, that was about 2013 when I started doing that stuff. And so I've been doing that ever since. I've run at least 5 or 6 different Kickstarter campaigns. I've worked with different publishers like Action Lab. I did a series with them called Midnight Over Stellar City, which was part of Hero Cats. So I worked with the writer there. And then, that's kind of my history so far. I've been doing illustration work outside of comics for Marvel for their entertainment properties. So I did illustration work for all their Netflix series like Daredevil and Punisher. And then now I've been doing a lot of the movies. So I've been doing I did Avengers Endgame, work for it, and then Captain Marvel and Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of that stuff. That's support kind of illustration stuff. I put t-shirts out and posters and things like that. But that's kind of neat. That's what stuff I love anyway. So being a part of that is really neat.
It is amazing, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And the last stuff I just worked on was stuff for the Eternals movie.
So
I get to see a little behind the scenes stuff on that, which is like the most biggest thing for fanboy.
To
let in the door and a little bit. So
it's, and you've decided to break your NDA and tell us all about that right now.
Yeah. It's an amazing contract, let me tell you. It's like
I'm sure.
But it's awesome. It's pretty fun. So
And with with your personal stuff, have you always been kind of writing and drawing? Has it been you kind of soup to nuts, or like how has that been?
You know, I've worked with different writers, like on the Giant Nitro series. We had Scott LaBelle writing it. We've had different writers over time on different projects that I've worked on. But when I started in the Kickstarter stuff, I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. So I'm just going to do it myself and see how it works out.
Yes.
And I've always liked creating characters and everything, but writing is when you write your own stuff, there's a freedom to it when you draw it that you don't have when you're collaborating. I think it's a little tougher. Like you get a little nervous about sticking exactly to a script or branching off from what the writer wrote.
Of course.
And that relationship can be, you know, you gotta give and take on that stuff. But when you're doing it yourself, you can just be totally free to do it. And I think that's the funnest part.
Of course.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm always curious, and you know, there's so many different ways of approaching this, you know, both as a team with a different artist or a different writer, but especially when you're writing your own material. You know, do you tend to find that you're kind of drawing and writing simultaneously? Are you kind of figuring out visually and then, you know, kind of building the story that way? Do you start with a script? Like, how do you kind of bring yourself into kind of putting those pieces together?
Yeah, it's sort of Marvel method, and the fact that I don't know where I'm going. I have a general idea. I've given myself what the writer would normally give, like, which is a loose outline. Like, I'm going over here. And so then I pace. That's based on pacing and everything, because I know that within this many pages, I need to have a decent amount of action or something happen that will intrigue the reader. And so I'm always thinking about it from the reader's side, but then I write it to make sure my characters are making sense and that the action's planned out. And I love to just do thumbnails while I'm writing and actually and work out the exact dialogue as I go. That can be a little tricky. You don't want to get it, but you can always rewrite it and look at it separate from the thumbnails and try to think through and make sure it's paced well just in the amount of writing. When you do that kind of stuff, you can really write with very few words. Like I always pull stuff out and I'm like, well, it's better now. Like I did for the Art vs. Apocalypse, I did the silent, silent piece from the Microverse. And that I really like doing, because I could just completely go without words and make it make sense. And that's kind of fun. Comics really work that way. You don't really, the words should only be additive. They don't need to be required to understand. So,
Don't tell someone like Alan Moore or Brian Michael Bendis that, but tend to agree with you. Very cool. Well, I want to go back to a couple things you talked about in your kind of secret origin story, because this stuff's just fascinating to me.
Sure.
So when you were kind of getting in the 90s and you talked about like the offshoot from slave labor, I mean, that to me was such a sweet spot in comics in general from a creative standpoint, like just the kind of feeling in the air, at least to me, more as a reader and collector, you know, at that point for me.
Right.
You know, that felt like such a kind of creative moment in the industry. You know, what was that like as you were, you know, trying to find your way in and those early days at slave labor, you know, I'm sure riding off the success of Milk and Cheese and things like that.
There was another guy that was doing a book called The Wretch, then that was Phil Hester.
I remember that. Absolutely.
And I really dig that book. That's pretty inspiring to me. But yeah, the doing any comics at that point were really fun, but it was the late 90s, you know, it was starting to be the point where things were kind of bottoming out from the boom. And so it was very difficult to make to survive in that state. That's why I say at that point I was a starving artist. I feel like I literally was at that point. But God, that's when I really found the love for that medium, and because that's before really video games have overtaken the market as much, and you know, there wasn't as much exposure to everything. You know, comics really had a fascinating place, and like I said, it was everywhere at the time. You know, things like TikTok and stuff wouldn't be anything if it didn't have the mass audience, right? Like,
absolutely.
Of course. So
when you take all those comics and you put them into only 3,000 stores, it's like, wow, that just cut down the appeal to being on that level, right? So,
no, absolutely.
That's why. So we have to deal with living with the biggest change from back then is now we have to live with the audience being much smaller and more focused.
Well, I would say, I know. From our point of view, it's interesting because I think, you know, this is something we probably talked about when we initially connected, but it's like there's the perception of the comics industry as the direct market, mostly because of how prominent Marvel and DC are. And certainly, I think, you know, they're not shy in saying I think there are a lot of challenges and problems with the way the direct market works at this point. But I think the comics medium, the art form, the audience for comics has never been bigger. It's just finding the ways to actually make that work from a business.
That's what you guys are working on.
You know, kind of ability to actually do this stuff in a way that makes sense. And that's, it's exactly what we're working on. But it's, you know, it's interesting to kind of look at, and especially, you know, being kind of in the similar time frame as you, like, you know, growing up at a point where I largely learned to read from, you know, reading comics. I certainly was largely influenced, you know, as a creative person and as an artist, as an illustrator, you know, because of comics. You know, so all that is incredibly formative, and that wouldn't have happened, you know, in our childhood if I couldn't buy them on the spinner rack at the gas station. You know, and that was incredibly, you know, formative, and just that's how you got comics. And it was like,
you look at those artists on those racks and they're everywhere. I mean, you go into a different store and they're there. You go to the grocery store and you're they're there. And you're thinking, wow, if I'm part of that, I'm everywhere.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right?
And that kind of level of exposure is very appealing when everybody's like nowadays, when everybody's talking about, oh, I want to be TikTok famous or I want to be this famous. Right. It's like, that was that thing back then.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I probably put it in those terms, but you're absolutely right.
That is actually a fascinating perspective. That's interesting.
So this is a super, probably applies to, like, you know, several hundred people on the planet. But when you picked up Excalibur, I so clearly remember picking up Excalibur number one. I think it was in like I was with my grandparents. I was in a kind of a drugstore where I got that book.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I still have it in a long box somewhere. But it was, you know, the first time I saw Alan Davis's work. So, you know, definite kind of instant kind of like, oh, my God, this stuff is amazing. Yeah. But also I have an edition of it that doesn't have a logo on the cover.
Oh, wow.
And so I came to find out in years later that is like some super rare, you know, version of that book. So I'm based on your reaction, I'm going to assume that wasn't the one you got, but I was curious.
I think I had, I feel like I've had a couple versions of the book, but it's been like the sky behind them standing there is a little different color or something like that. But other than that, I've never seen that version. That was inspiring because his storytelling is just so amazing. The characters have such a life to them, and they have like personality, and the body language is so well done between characters. I mean, it's fascinating.
That's a great, I mean, that's something I think I kind of learned from him, and, you know, probably a handful of other comics artists that you know are so good at. It's not just, you know, the same character with a different hairstyle. It's like, you know, these characters really have different personalities, and, you know, how to try to convey that in the, you know, even just all of them standing together in a in a lineup, and, you know, how much that can actually do to help with telling the story that you want to tell.
Yeah.
So super cool. So I also picking back through a couple of the notes that you said. So I very those kind of things, the Flash taking over the web, and I was doing kind of some similar work at that point, which was interesting times. And then we never tried to make QuickTime skins, but I remember them very, very well. So kudos.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, I did some really crazy experiments. Like I built a calculator app inside QuickTime.
Yeah.
I did all sorts of crazy stuff that had like 3D stuff everywhere in it. Yeah, it was nuts. It's fun.
That's so cool. And I actually remember the Johnny Nitro stuff too. So I had not really put that together in our previous conversation that was you, but that makes me like you even more. It's awesome.
Well, that's kind of where my style, when I came back to it, I was like, okay, I need to incorporate that. I need to have harsh shadows. I need to have things built around that without outlines. Because when we did the visual conversion of video, I would take out and I would redraw a lot of pieces as well. But I had that base of that rotoscoped black and white starting point. So it kind of looked very Frank Miller, Sin City-ish,
What did your work look like before that?
I was doing something similar. But I was doing a lot with manga at the time. Like I really loved Battle Angel Alita. And so I was doing my version of that, but with a Frank Miller Inc. style. So I was like,
"Oh, that's cool."
Yeah. So that was my thing. I did that for a while, and then once we started doing the online animation, I kind of stopped drawing as much, and kind of went off more in the tech side of things.
Yeah. But, Super cool. Well, I do love your style, and it's great to hear you talk about that progression, because I think you can kind of see how all those pieces fit together.
Yeah, it was.
Go ahead.
It's really hard to find your own style and say this is how I'm going to draw. And it always amazes me when people actually pick one and stick with it. It's so easy to want to just shift around, right, and play around.
Yeah.
Like
I was one of thousands of people, I'm sure, that decided I was going to be somewhere between Art Adams and Todd McFarlane, and kind of went back and forth between the two, mostly on the Art Adams side.
Yeah.
And then the thing that was, the most formative to me, and this is the advice I always pass on to other people who talk about, trying to find your drawing style. And I actually think the more work we've done in different mediums, I think it applies to writing, it applies to storytelling. I think, it is kind of, finding your voice in any creative medium. And the advice is from Brian Stelfreeze, who was one of the mentors that I had kind of growing up.
Sure.
And he, he said to me, I'm sitting there, watching him draw over, 3 days at Dragon Con, not wanting to do anything else other than watch him draw. And we're talking about style. And, his advice was, look, the thing is, if you are copying someone else's style or trying to, emulate what they're doing, you're essentially a Xerox of a Xerox or a photocopy of a photocopy, because they picked up whatever they picked up from, somewhere else, and they picked up whatever they picked up from somewhere else. And so, his advice, which I always pass on, is like, if you really want to find your style, you've got to just go back to fundamentals. And that is, the way that you draw something is going to emerge by actually drawing that thing. And so, he would always talk about it in terms of hands. It's like, if you practice drawing hands and you're drawing, from life and you're drawing real hands, like there are going to be quirks and mistakes and things that you make that are uniquely your mistakes, your quirks.
Right.
And ultimately that's your style.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually really empowering, because to me that, felt like a certain amount of freedom to go like, oh, I don't need to try to make this be something. And, you'll find stuff along the way that you like, or that you feel like, oh, I want to, continue down this road. But it's not, my life prior to that was just like, oh man, it doesn't look like Art Adams.
Yeah. I definitely got influenced by Stelfreeze early on as well. I remember I was in Oklahoma somewhere at a comic book shop, and I was probably maybe in college, maybe early in college. And I was digging through back issue boxes, and I found Psycops, which was a 3-issue series he did, I think, in 1988. Yeah. But then it's all black and white. So you could, this is something I should point out about black and white comics at the time. is that you have to think, when it's color, you have a halftone pattern over that. Mm-hmm. And registry was not good back then on a lot of comics. So they didn't look that good in color. So when you had a crisp black and white and had somebody that really knew how to ink, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. Like it blew. Yeah. It was the sharpest version you're going to get of that book, because that black and white printing is this one plate, and it's printing those feather lines perfectly. So I love that black and white series. And so that was pretty inspiring to me. And then when he did Batman Black and White in like 96 or so, I was those pages were just like my grail. I just held on to those and like stared at those pages, but Xerox them up and like look at them and just keep them around. And then when I moved to the South near Atlanta, now where I live, I immediately went to Dragon Con and met Brian, and then they were having a gaijin party that night, and I hung out and talked to everybody, and it was fun. And then I ended up later on working on their website, helping them out with that stuff.
That's awesome. Awesome. Small world. I love it.
Absolutely. That's the comic book world where it's very,
that's the comic book world. Very small even the adjacent to comic book world.
Anybody on the outside.
I remember going to Gaijin in Atlanta. I grew up in Savannah, Georgia, so I would go there in the summers and hang out with them a little bit. And I had gotten into, like, I was a skateboarder at the time, and I had this pretty bad, like, road rash skateboard accident. So, like, half the side of my face was all, like, scabbed up and everything. and that was the first time I met Coley at the studio. And he was, you know, took me out to get, I don't know, I guess we were going to get coffee for everybody or something. And he just would not stop teasing me about this, like, two-face accident the entire time. good group of guys, an amazing group of artists.
Cool. Every time I see Cully, he's like, this is the guy that helped us with our website. every convention I see him at, that's what he says.
That's funny. You're like, can we talk about my books?
Move beyond that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that was cool and all, but very cool. Well, talk to me. This is the other question I had for you. I am a sort of illustrator. This is all, again, sort of a geeky art thing. But like, I'm an illustrator guy. I love working in vectors and love working in Illustrator. But I have never done the kind of inking. Like, you actually ink in Illustrator, quote unquote, ink in Illustrator.
Right. No, absolutely.
So talk to me a little bit about that. And for anyone that doesn't understand what that means, so, you know, Illustrator is a vector program, meaning that it's essentially creating mathematical representations of lines and shapes, which you can blow up, you know, to any size at ultimate resolution. There really is no resolution, versus something like Photoshop, which is constrained by actual pixel density. So if you have something that's, you know, 300 pixels wide by 300 pixels tall, if you then make that, you know, 1,000 pixels wide by 1,000 pixels tall, it's going to become degraded and, you know, quote unquote pixely. So there's some major advantages to working Illustrator because of that flexibility. But how did you start doing that, and what's that process for you? I'm not even quite sure how you're doing it. So for the creative
mystery
among us.
Yes. Well, I should point out that, you know, people do Clip Studio Pro, I think, right?
Yeah,
and like, absolutely. They use their vector layers in there too, and stuff. I mean, it's not just Illustrator, but Illustrator is unique in the way it functions and the way. And I grew up, you know, ever since college using Illustrator and Freehand, which was two programs that were kind of competing at the time, and then they all became one. And so I've been working in that forever. But I've done a lot of logo design. And so in 2013, I was like, well, I don't want to pick a resolution. Because I kept looking around going, well, is 2,000 pixels wide for a page good? Right. I don't know. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to try this and see if I can work out a process that works for me. And so I started that, and I started just inking pages. Like, I took some Brian Stelfreeze's images and just started inking them in Illustrator, and worked out kind of like a way that felt natural enough to me. And I loved, like, I'd done a lot of work with brushes and ink and pages and physical stuff for a long time. So it was like, I can fill all this in with black in seconds. And so that was my big thing. I can just draw 4 points and there's a huge black area. And so that saves so much time, because when you draw with a lot of black, it's one thing if you're drawing, you know, just with a ton of outlines and you're drawing just lines over and over, but I'm filling in stuff. So it's slowing me way down. And speed, yeah. I thought for every, since this was going to be a side thing for me anyway, I mean, it was a side hustle at the time. I'm like, well, I got to be really quick because comic book artists work so fast anyway, and I'm limiting my time down. So working with the illustrator, I just said, well, how fast can I do this and how can I do this effectively? So I would sketch literally on a piece of paper next to me and just take a picture of my phone and immediately just airdrop it right into my layers, you know, and like start inking right over that. And I would just black out areas first, which is a reversal of what I typically would do. I would normally just draw clean lines around the figures and that kind of thing. But here I was working with shadows first. And so then I started manipulating those shadows. Like I'd turn off the layer with the drawing after I just drew the shadows up. And then I would start sculpting in a way. I would start moving the points around and adjusting. And sometimes I would redraw an arm that way and like just work with the big blocks of black and balancing that way. I would balance out the whole page or the whole pinup kind of drawing in just the black areas. And so I really started letting that be kind of organic to where I could rework it that way and play with it. And I was getting much better results that way. And so I would only add lines that were required after that point, like where I felt like it was a little vague or maybe it just needed a little something. I would just add those only, and that kept it kind of minimal. And then I only would use in Illustrator, I only use certain brushes. Like I wouldn't use pressure sensitivity. I would just use brushes that were already pre-shaped, like thick to thin brushes that were already shaped that way. And then I'd use, what was great working digitally is you could use white all you wanted. So I could use white lines next to my black lines, and I'd use what I call cut lines. And that way I could draw right back in my black. And so I could blend that way with little lines here and there. And I just liked that way that looked. And it kind of just, I just kept repeating that same process. I would draw all the dark blacks, then add a couple little lines here and there and use the same kind of splatter brushes effects and stuff.
Yeah.
And then that kind of became my style.
I just
kept repeating that.
Well, it's super cool. I mean, I'm into it both from a you know, kind of technical standpoint and from a visual, you know, creative standpoint. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, just, and you, when you turned in your Reverse Apocalypse pages and then I got to see the original art for that, it really surprised me. Like it doesn't look like these are, you know, just vector, you know, pieces. You've kind of gone out of your way, you know, intentionally or just cause it's what you kind of vibe with to make it still have sort of an organic handcrafted feel to it, which obviously it is, but I think there's a, there's a tendency for some people using vectors to get very, try to be overly technical or overly precise, probably because it's so often used for logo design and stuff like that. It still has a very handcrafted feeling to it.
Yeah. It can be when you start off, it's very cold, right? Like it's very mechanical and then you just keep reworking it until it feels more natural and it gets easier the more you do it that way. The way the changing tail style, is a little bit different than my normal. Like I have basically two little versions of my style, and the changing tails version is a little more simplified, a little bit more Mike Mignola esque, in the way I treat it because I don't do any of the splatter brushes I typically do. I let it be a little more simplified. But I keep my hard edges and stuff like that. Like I don't round things that much. You have to, in comic book art, there's a big thing about having a lot of variety in your line and your shapes and stuff like that. That way it feels more professional. There's if you think about it, when you're new to something, you're going to do the same thing over and over on, and you're going to use the same line. Like you don't know to vary it up. And so, a lot of times when you're new, it'll look kind of amateurish if you're using the same kind of technique on every single thing. So here I'm using a certain type of line, and then I do a certain types of like big blocky areas, and then I do a certain types of shapes and things, and I just repeat those over and over. And as long as you have three or four of those options, like those things you're mixing together, the better it looks.
Absolutely. Well, I think what's cool about the Changing TL style, and what a great segue, by the way.
Seriously.
What's cool about the what's also cool about the Changing TL style, which people will get to see on Macroverse in about a week, is that you're also kind of combining it with what feels like more, I guess where I'm going is like the color style feels mm-hmm. more kind of organic as well. So there's a cool kind of combination of, you know, kind of a more graphic black and white, you know, kind of line shape, mm-hmm. You know, style to the drawing, but then it has a almost more slightly painterly feel to the color work.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a cool combination as well.
I've studied like coloring traditionally comics, right? And I've bought books, mm-hmm. I've like done online class type stuff. And this style, the way I do it, is completely not anything like that. Like, I don't follow anybody's rules or how technique. I've completely like, okay, here I shade with blacks and I do some,
yeah,
you know, and it's this percentage. And I limit myself to like, I think it's 7 different layers and they all have different percentages. And I only use certain colors on certain layers and that's it. Mm-hmm. And I do everything that's with cool. that. Right. And so it creates a palette that's very uniform all the way through the book. I mean, it doesn't shift around mm-hmm. a lot. There's not like a big color red in the middle of one page that doesn't exist in another or anything like mm-hmm. that. It doesn't mm-hmm. really color shift based on light, which yeah. would seem a little better if I probably did that. But this becomes just the, it becomes its look is essentially yeah. how I think about it.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah.
And one thing I do with Changing Tales too is I don't draw any like irises in the eyes. Which is like, right. mm-hmm. I know that makes it look maybe a little creepy in some ways, but I love that. That's a little better.
Yeah.
Like whenever I have drawings that I leave that out, I always think that looks so much cooler. Like everybody's Batman. Like everybody's got the no eyes, like just the white slits kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, oh, that's yeah. very cool. I'm looking at it literally right now, and you're absolutely right. That's suddenly slightly disturbed. It's great.
Yeah. Yeah. In Changing Tales, it's the story wise, it's based around Grimm fairy tales. So it's all the characters are yeah. reliving their story in a loop, basically in a cycle. And so eventually some of the characters become aware they're in this loop and they start to break free. Like, so the huntsman from Snow White starts making different choices. And so that causes everything to change. And so, hence the big name, the Changing Tales. So,
Now, is this something you've always been? Because, you know, I've always loved the original fairy tales and the kind of goriness of all these
they're very
Disney-fied
rough.
Things.
Yeah,
you know, both obviously with Grimm, Brothers Grimm and Hans Christian Andersen. These are all mm-hmm. kind of deeply tragic tales, many of them. Is this something you've been interested in for a long time? Has this been something you developed over a while? Like, how did you come about? How did the idea come about?
Right. Well, I think when I first started doing it, I was like, I've always looked at like, characters that are public domain and stuff and thought, well, I'd love to base this on something else. I'd love to take a character that's got some kind of history. Cause in comics, that's what we do, right? We take Spider-Man, we mm-hmm. make something new about him. So I've always thought, well, it'd be really interesting to work with some of these characters and it'd be neat to, what if this happened and this happened? And so mm-hmm. I kind of thought, well, this would be interesting if we take, you know, characters we kind of already know and then twist it and make it way different and make our versions of them. And so that playing around with that and listening, like I'd start finding like the most original translations of fairy tales and things and try to listen to those and see what kind of craziness is in there. And then that mm-hmm. would just spark all sorts of ideas when I heard that. And so I just loved writing that way, like hearing that and then just getting inspired all the time.
Right. Now, I mean, because you talk about kind of more being Marvel method in terms of writing, but this mm-hmm. feels like a story that needs to be planned out more. You seem to, it seems like you need to know where you're going and how these ending and where, like, you know, all these different threads you're weaving. So how do you balance those two approaches?
I've always thought I would hate to be on like a team book, because the complexity of it, you know, but that's where I ended up going a lot with this stuff. Mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. it just like the huntsman ends up starting to build his own team eventually and assembling people in a way. But,
and I love the wolf who is perpetually hungry. Just this is just a fantastic kind of supporting character.
He's definitely the Deadpool of my world. On that, Because you gotta have that now. So it's really, with all the dramatic sayings and stuff, you gotta have somebody in there that's not so dramatic. Or just saying the crazy stuff. So it's fun. Riding Hood and the Wolf, they're a big part of the story as well.
Interesting. And now obviously you've got the kind of the first book is completely done, or the first set of stories. Like where are you taking, do you know where you're going with it? Do you know what good plans for how to move, continue?
There's I hate to give away too much because people probably read, but there is a character, I'll just go ahead and spoil a little bit.
Spoiler. Okay. We
can say it. Minor spoilers. Obvious. Consider them teasers.
Yeah. But the Snow White character, you know, is shifted in her, in basically when the huntsman breaks free, he scars Snow White, making her not the fairest of them all. So he cuts her face, and that's how he escapes his tail. Yeah. And so Snow White ends up becoming a very kind of tormented character and kind of comes after him in the storyline. And so then she's kind of, she ends up almost like trying to take her own life at one point. And so that story is going to continue on a little bit after the pages that I already have. That's nice. Kind of where the first part ends for me right now. Yeah. Of course, there's a lot of the stuff in there that happens as well. But
oh no, it's a great cliffhanger ending. It has to be said. Like,
yeah,
it's like end of season one. Holy shit!
We love that. It's when you make a book or any kind of story, it's the most important thing is that you have something, some kind of message really in there that you're delivering. I feel like the ones that are just plot and it's nothing more are so shallow now. Like we see right through it. So it's just, if it's just moving one thing to another, like scene, it's really not enough. And so the Changing Trails is really about the characters dealing with the shift and the fact that they had this life where they knew what was going to happen in a way, and they were comfortable, right? Even though some of them were very tormented by it and it was very tragic tales. So some of them were very happy to be out of that loop. And they're looking forward to having the uncertainty being in charge of their own destiny. And so, you have two factions, really. You have the people that don't want to be let loose and the people that want to be in the comfort of the repeat.
Yes.
And so...
Yeah. No, it feels like you're kind of... It's interesting, without wanting to get kind of go in this direction, but it feels like it's very much a kind of political allegory allegory of the divisions which a lot of society is facing today. It's a kind of fascinating take on that.
And I think we've always dealt with either that, even in the smallest ways too. Like even if it's just you've repeated stuff in your own life, you do the same routine every day, and you just one day go, you know, I don't need to change all this. So you just mix up what you do. And that is a huge thing. So I think we all know that to be kind of the reality of how we live. Mm-hmm. And so that tying that into there makes my characters a little more alive.
Yeah.
Well, there's something interesting in there too, at least to me, like in my interpretation of it, that, you know, just on a kind of fundamental level about, you know, I think there's a storytelling convention of, you know, what do characters want, and that kind of being the driving, you know, thing for each character. But bringing that back to kind of where that's relatable, you know, in life is, you know, we all have wants and desires, and then we balance that against a certain level of comfort. We balance that against a certain level of expectations of what the world is, and all those things kind of go into a, you know, kind of a certain experience of life. And so I think it does get really interesting from a kind of meta level of, you know, a character that's sort of set in a world that we all have an expectation for how that world is supposed to be, in a way that we all have an expectation for what our life is supposed to be. And then being able to have a moment to go like, well, maybe it's not that. and you know, that I think becomes very relatable in this, you know, incredible kind of backdrop of something that's very familiar and yet is at the same time going in a direction that we're not quite sure where it's going to go. And to me, that's sort of the magic trick of it is sort of being able to balance all of those elements against each other, which I think you do quite
very well. Well, I think it also speaks to something bigger, kind of in society as a whole, which is, you know, is your future determined by your circumstance, or what control do you have over that? And I think this, in a way that comics have kind of always done, and in their own way, it speaks to that very, very nicely. So, no, I'm excited. It's a terrific series.
Yeah.
Awesome. It's funny having you guys. It was very funny listening to you guys kind of geeking out about, you know, the obviously X-Men and the Marvel comics or whatever. Growing up in England with 2000 AD, I never read a Marvel comic in my life until I came here. And so it's very nice having these little chunks of story, kind of almost page by page, be like, no, great, I can relate to this. This is what I grew up with.
I know these characters.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. This is just this is great.
Yes. Very cool. Alex, what? Yeah. Anything else you want to say about Changing Tales? I mean, we're super excited to it coming to Macroverse, and just to give people a little bit of detail around that. So the first episode will hit the platform on the 27th of this month, which is July. So
next week.
If you're listening to this anytime between now and then, that's when it will come out. And if it's after that, it's out, and you should go read it. and then episodes every week after that until this first season is done, and then, you know, be making plans for kind of where it goes from there. But anything else that you want to share with people about, you know, kind of why this is work that you want to do, or, you know, why they should read it, or anything beyond what you've already said?
I think the platform, other than, you know, what we typically know as comics, you know, reading a sequential page, I think playing with this and kind of experiencing the click-through method that the app has, I think is, even if you've read this book before, because I did have this book, you know, somewhat around the few people that have gotten it from conventions and things, you know, they've seen it a little bit. I think even this changes the experience. And I think that that is a really good thing, because, you know, we've all read pages and we've seen comics as usual, and it's just nice to kind of mix it up. And so I think it's really neat. I hope people check it out.
Thank you. Well, awesome.
Thank you.
Well,
yes.
We certainly do too. And I, you know, it is the, you know, it's super fun for us to work with people like you that, you know, have a wide range of experience and kind of understand how a lot of these things go together. Cause it also allows, I think, for a level of, you know, kind of collaboration and kind of playing with, you know, what can we do here? And we're, you know, we very much feel like we're still figuring it out as well. So it's, fun to have these, you know, this new toolbox to play with.
As a creator, I can point something out that I think is interesting. You know, when in comics we design pages a certain way based on page turn, because, you know, that page turn is the most, that's the moment when you can actually surprise somebody. Like if you're going to do a jump scare in a horror movie, that's like when it happens, right? You turn the page, it's a double page spread. It's like, wow, look at that. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And so this is different than that, right? This you can time completely differently. And so I, as a creative, that kind of opens the door of not having that predictability of the page turn moment and having something different happen. So I mean, I think it's pretty neat to be able to even mix it up even that much more and think about something completely different on that pacing level.
Well, and that makes me and us, I think, super excited, because I think it is, you know, that my favorite thing is when we get stuff in that, you know, people are kind of playing with this in a way that we haven't yet really thought about. And you know, there have been a couple of moments where you've done that, and that makes me delighted. So.
Hopefully I can do a lot more.
Absolutely. Very cool. I think I interrupted you, Adam. Go ahead.
Oh, no. I'll go echo that. It's encouraging to hear you say that, because that has been the response from a couple of creators that we've spoken to and friends that have, you know, written and created in the traditional comics medium before, and just treating every tap as a page turn, and the ability to do that is fantastic. Which is great. It's like you say, land a jump scare, land a joke, you know, create dialogue in a way that's unique. It's exciting, but it's doubly exciting to hear you say that, kind of independent of any conversation with us. It's great.
I think we're always working with our limitations, right? And so when you're working with a print book, there's lots of limitations, and there's reasons why it was constructed the way it is. There's traditions that are happening. There's understanding that we're assuming is there because they of the past and the way they've read before. And so it's just a whole different thing when you have a different way of clicking through those images and the sequencing and all that. You can, and people are going to be, people are going to invent new things with it. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And, yes, and thanks for joining us.
Indeed. Indeed.
So other than taking over the world with us, with Macroverse, are there any other kind of big things that you want to, share about things you're working on or things you're interested in?
I'm working with Shane Berryhill on a project, which is he wrote Sherwood, Texas.
It really is a small world.
Yeah, that is a really small world. That's what
Shane's local to me, so we've talked. Mm-hmm. We've done books or kind of stories inside of anthology books and stuff together. But never in a very long form yet. So we wanted to do a 48-page little graphic novel, and so we started to kickstart one last year, but we ended up it didn't fund, and we kind of went back to the drawing board a little bit. And so I've been doing a ton of character design for that and kind of developing work, that kind of world. And then we've got an artist in Italy that's drawing it, and he's bringing a whole different kind of feel to it, and I'm loving it. And that will be kickstarting at some point this year. And, it'll be really neat. But it's called Jason and the Olympians.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like a female Voltron force is what I always say.
Oh, nice.
Even though that probably doesn't sum it up very well, but it's all kind of all like vehicles that are different kind of Greek character, like monsters and stuff, all form into a giant robot. So, yeah.
That's super cool.
I can't wait as a Greek
myth. It's pretty fun. Shane put together a really good script.
That sounds amazing. Yes.
Yeah.
So it'll be, I'm going to be excited when we launch that on Kickstarter eventually.
Yeah, that's super cool. That is super brilliant. Cool. Well, I'm going to talk to you more about that offline as well.
but people can follow me on my website, alexogle.com, and my Instagram is probably my best, which is probably my social media to follow. But all my stuff's linked off my website, my Twitter, my Facebook, and everything.
Yeah, and we'll put links to that stuff in the show notes as well. So anybody that's listening to this on your podcasting platform of choice, if you check out the show notes, there will be links to find Alex on social media and other places. Alex, we tend to wrap these up with something we call the Hoojima flip. Adam, what is a Hoojima flip?
A Hoojima flip is just a word that I don't know if it's a British word or if it's just something I invented for whatever is top of mind at the moment. The Hoojima flip. It's essentially that. So,
I call it the British whatchamacallit. So kind of the thing that you've been inspired by recently or some cool thing you've come across. It could be related to something we've talked about, completely unrelated to something we've talked about. Just any recommendation for people to check out.
You know what? I'm going to recommend a book that I actually, I guess I started reading it earlier this year, called Family Tree. It's by Phil Hester and Jeff Lemire. Mm-hmm. I only got a couple issues because my comic shop didn't have the other ones, but they're up to like issue 8 now, I think, from Image. And I recommend people checking that out. I think that book's probably been overlooked by a lot of people, but Phil Hester's art is just always so much fun. And it's a pretty interesting storyline going. So I think that's a good one to check out.
Very cool. We'll put that in the notes as well. Adam, do you have a Hoojima flip for the evening?
I mean, I do. The Old Guard on Netflix, and it's obviously one of the hit shows. Yeah. But we saw that this week, and it's fantastic.
Yes,
just basically loved every second of it. And
totally,
Charlize Theron is fantastic, and I believe it's the first kind of comic book adaptation directed by a black woman, which is kind of great. And it's gay characters in there. Like, it just kind of checks every box in terms of me.
Yeah.
Like, it's just great. It's an awesome film, and it's got some of the best action I've seen in a while. So it's just great.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the other cool thing about it, I heard an interview talking about this, but it's also, I believe, maybe the first, if not certainly the first, of these kind of big Netflix movies that has been adapted that's also written by the creator and writer of the comic. So Greg Rucka created the Image series and then also wrote the screenplay For the movie. And I would say that there's a pretty good bet there will be another one.
At some point
when people can be together in the real world again.
When we can actually film things again.
I was actually watching Train to Busan today.
Oh, yeah.
How was that?
Oh, that's fantastic. Like, that's my favorite zombie thing.
Terrific.
Yes.
That's my favorite zombie movie ever so far.
See,
so.
If that's zombies awesome. Didn't just utterly terrify me, I would
be that. Me too.
Yes. Now, this is always, you know, people will get sick of us talking about this as well that have listened to this show for a while, but this is the cruel irony is, you know, Adam is deathly afraid of only a few things, but probably number one on that list is actually zombies.
Most definitely zombies.
and yet the series that we write is about, well, it's not about zombies, but it features zombies.
Oh, very, so, very strongly. Yeah. Yes.
It's very funny.
Well, they say channel your art to confront your fears, right? So
That's right.
Exactly. Hasn't worked for me yet, but
Exactly. So my Hoojima Flip is an app that I came across, which is something I've been wanting for a while. So in this new world order where we're all doing Zoom calls and remote conversations, all this stuff, I've been feeling left out from the beginning because I have a tower of my computer is a tower, and I have a Cintiq as my monitor, which I work at, and so no webcam. And so I'm always the guy on the call with, like, you know, hey, sorry you can't see me, but you can hear my voice. I've started, I was like, do I need to buy a webcam? It's like, you know, I've been doing some live streaming as well with people. Like, you know, it's weird to, like, be the only guy in the room that can't be seen. So I've been wanting this to exist, and it finally does exist. There's an app called Camo Studio. You download it for your phone, you download it for your computer, and it lets you use your phone as a webcam, which not only in my limited testing so far has worked really, really quite well, but also is a higher quality camera, much higher quality camera than you would have on a traditional webcam. So
I actually use another app.
Go for it.
Epoch Cam.
Oh, yes. I tried that one. I couldn't get that one to work for me, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it works good for me. I use Wi-Fi. It does HD over Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And I can literally put my camera anywhere around my monitor and shoot. Because I started doing the same thing, but when I wanted to do, like, maybe drawing tutorials and things where I wanted multiple cameras going. So I needed to have, I was like, well, my phone's the best camera I have right here. And then I have older phones that aren't being used that I've never, you know, I've just discontinued, right? Like old iPhone 7s and stuff. And so I can use it on there as well.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Well, I'll have to give that one another whirl as well. But yeah, so Camo Studio has also been working well for me. It does require it be wired, though. So there's a certain appeal to the Wi-Fi version.
Oh, I do have another app recommendation if you want me to do something else.
Yes.
Comic Draw. Have you ever heard of this app on the iPad Pro?
You're breaking a tiny bit here.
Comic Draw.
Comic Draw. It's an app. It's an app for iPad, and it lets you do every stage of a comic book in it. Like, you can do multi pages, and so you can actually pencil, like, ink, color, and letter in the same app, and build out PDFs directly out of it. And so it's really amazing. I've done 24-hour comic day multiple times now. And last year I did it using that app. It was great I was able to do it all digitally in the same app and actually letter my whole book and everything right there. So I highly recommend checking that out and use the Apple Pencil and all that with it.
And it's Eben again. I think we were doing pretty good recording-wise, but then this one last little bit where I tell Alex about how excited we are to have a series on the app got all impossible to understand. So I said that, super excited, it's awesome, and then we came back with this.
I'm sure this will all just be the beginning.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. It's been great. Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Alex. Great to meet you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have a fantastic rest of your night.
You too. Cheers.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.